Former Olympic medalist and Tour de France podium finisher, Coach Bobby J invites you to put your socks on. Winning and losing, training and racing, agony and defeat, all of it comes down to understanding what works and what doesn't. For that, you need an experienced and accomplished coach. From insightful analysis into our sport's most iconic races and racers, to educational, entertaining, and actionable advice. Fizzo is an illuminating deep dive into the art and science of racing. Legends, fan clubs, at the races, super fans, and how it all works. Join Coach Bobby J alongside his Outskirts visionary co-host, Gus Morton. Prepare to be prepared. It's time to put your socks on.
Hello and welcome to our brand new cycling podcast where we cover bike racing. My name is Gus Morton and I'm here with Coach Bobby. Let's give a quick breakdown of what the show is going to be about. We are at the Tour of California. Today was stage one. We're going to cover a little bit of the ins and outs of how the race went down. Tour of California started in Sacramento, finished in Sacramento. 88-mile stage, 143 Ks with 200 feet of elevation gain. It was pretty hot out there. It was in the 80s. The course, it was flat, pretty boring until the last couple of K, last 15K when we got into town and we whipped a few laps around the state capital. Peter Sagan won the stage. Coach Bobby, give us a bit of a rundown.
Yeah, quite a boring stage actually, but we've done that sort of stage before. I think that a lot of the riders coming over from Europe just kind of wanted to get this day kicked off. I think that would probably be one of the easiest breakaways of the season to get into because, as you could see, there was not that many people trying to do it. First breakaway with four guys, with Mickey Schaar, Lawrence DeVries, Tyler Stites, and Georges Planet. I really like that name. I was calling him Planet until I heard that he was from France. Those guys got out there and, you know, seemed to work well enough together until that first intermediate sprint, and then it kind of all went sideways there for a little bit. And then the two more experienced guys, Mickey Schaar and Lawrence DeVries, decided to sit up and leave those two young guns to fight it out to the circuits. So not the most exciting start, but I think the guys kind of needed that to get their legs turning a little bit, you know, getting over the jet lag, you know, dealing with the time change, the heat, you know, trying to keep their powder dry for tomorrow as well. So not the most interesting stage, but yeah, once we got onto those circuits, then it changed, didn't it?
Exactly. And I think, I mean, what I thought was quite funny and all the commentators and I mean, everyone, like that first intermediate sprint when Mickey Schaar hit it like a kilometer to go, you're like, what on earth is he doing? But like, I guess that's what the intermediate sprints are for, right? And so often I think that nowadays in cycling, the breakaway, they never really contest those that fiercely. So it was kind of cool, you know, a little bit of racing going on before they all decided just to pull over the side and wait for the group to come.
Yeah, that was a little bit unconventional, but I know Mickey pretty well and he doesn't have the best sprint. So he was probably just trying to hit him where they weren't looking. And it didn't work out. It didn't work out. And our national team guy came through and flew the flag right from the start with winning that first intermediate sprint.
Yeah, exactly. It was a good ride by Stites. And he's one of the guys we're going to be looking at probably across the week. He's a young guy on the national team. But one thing I learned about Stites that I want to bring up straight away is he can beatbox. He's a beatboxer. Bobby, you got any hidden talents?
Well, now I love the guy already. If he can beatbox, that you know, growing up in the 80s, being exposed to, you know, all the new generation of hip hop and rap, I used to try to beatbox, very, very bad at it. Just like I tried to break dance and was terrible at that. But it's still my favorite genre of music.
I wonder if there's any video footage of that.
Luckily not. I could moonwalk though. It only took me 6 months. It only took me 6 months to learn, but I could moonwalk.
There you go. Did not expect that. Let's go to the last 15K of the stage on those finishing circuits. then it started to heat up and things got pretty fast in there. Were you someone to, like, when you were racing, did you ever get involved in that sort of thing?
Oh man, I tried to stay out of that as far away as possible. But on that same circuit, I don't remember what year it was, maybe 2007. We came onto the circuits and we did what the Quickstep boys did today, which was just make sure that we get onto those circuits and then just basically team time trial it from the front. Today, I kind of got the idea that they launched a little bit early. And then once they got to the circuits, especially after that second bonus sprint, then it kind of set up and it looked like it was a little chess match of who's going to take over. And then Sunweb got up there and it looked like maybe the Koenig Quickstep were being a little bit overconfident. And then it looked like they just got swamped there at the end. And I mean, it was a free for all. Thank goodness everybody came through unscathed. But I've been on that course and there's very little places to move up. You got a lot of guys dive bombing on the inside of the corner, which, you know, can flick themselves half the time because they have to hit the brakes too hard. But I was particularly watching the way that Peter Sagan was basically crowd surfing through the peloton there. And yeah, he, you know, the lead out train kind of got unorganized and Peter always comes on top. You know, he's a freelancer. He gets in there, he rides the wheels. He obviously has the condition to make those accelerations when he needs to. But I tell you one thing, Travis McCabe was coming back on him. If that was another 50 meters, you never know, we would have had our first win for the national team.
And that would have been huge. Yeah, I wanted to make a point, like Travis, like I had him on my list before the start, only because I've raced with him and because, you know, you want to see the underdog do really well. And like, he can climb well, you know, he can survive those lumpy and tough days. And I think with tomorrow looking like it's going to be just a death march up to Lake Tahoe, I think that's going to deaden a few legs. And so he could be looking to find himself a stage win as the week progresses. And I hope, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. But yeah, crazy finish there. Like a couple of the big teams kind of mistimed that finish. I guess great move by Lotto with George Bennett. Cheeky little move there, which was thwarted by one of the riders from Richie Port's team. But it was cool to see that. I like George, and it was great to see like the GC guys right from the get go into it. You know, chasing the bonus seconds, and you know, I'm glad I'm not involved in that because that just makes the racing so much more stressful and difficult. You know, for those GC guys like throughout the whole week. But it's cool to watch, and it makes it good, and it kind of makes it exciting, and you get to start to see the tactics play out. Yeah, I hope that's an indication of how the rest of the week's going to play out, how aggressive it's going to be. And
every second counts in this race with the lack of a time trial this year. So yeah, right away, not only is it higher caravan position, but you know, 1 second, you know, races have been won and lost by less than 1 second this year. And those were races that had a time trial in it. So good for him getting up there and, you know, blowing out the pipes a little bit.
Exactly. And I think let's maybe just have a look really quickly at the week of racing and kind of just give a quick overview. Like, tell me about, I mean, you've done this race. You did the first edition?
Yes.
Like, can you just give me a bit of a rundown of like how that race has changed between then and now and then how you kind of see this week playing out?
Yeah, in 2006, it was super exciting. It was the first time that we've had a race of this caliber over here in the U.S. And, you know, it was in February and every single U.S. rider came to play. There was not a single one of us that was like, oh, no, I'm preparing the tour. I'm preparing something. Every single one of us that showed up was gunning for it. And we had some great races. I kind of got the feeling the first couple years that it was a little bit more glamorous than it is now. And by that, I mean, you know, the race organization went out of their way. They're like, oh man, these guys are coming all the way over from Europe. You know, what can we do for them? And they gave like little presents to people, you know, to every guy on the team. And, you know, you have some of these guys that are making $1 million a year, but I remember the first year it was like I think it was an iPod mini Then it was like a digital camera, a Garmin, something like that. And you wouldn't believe, like, when guys got back over to Europe, they were like, oh, it's so great, we all got free iPods. And, you know, these things are like, what, $120? But it added a little bit of, hey, I'm going to do that race next year because, hey, maybe they'll give the iPad away. They never wound up giving iPad. They never gave away iPads, by the way. But, you know, we stayed at some really, really nice hotels. I think that's kind of, you know, now that the race has gotten bigger and it's been taken over by ASO, you know, they're looking at the bean counter guys a little bit more. But those first couple years, man, we were going through the marquee towns and starts and finishes and staying in the greatest hotels and eating really good food. Now, I have to admit, because I was there with George's Hincapie Halowesco team in 2016, I guest DS'd for them. And then I was there last year with the Halowesco Citadel team. And yeah, I was kind of blown. I was kind of disappointed. I was like, wait a second, you guys don't get any, you know, free little swag. And you kind of have to stay in these little, you know, motel too cheap for the hotel sort of things. But, you know, looking at the race, the distances are so long, you know, outside of today and the final two stages, you know, you're going to be on your bike for what, 120 to 130 miles, you know, with that stage, especially tomorrow. And is that really necessary? I know, hey, listen, my dad was a race promoter. I can sit here, you know, on my sofa and, you know, criticize things. But for me, like, you're getting guys to come all the way over from Europe. It's kind of in a transition period between the spring classics and the preparation for the tour. Do they really need those long stages, or wouldn't it be more fun to make those stages a little bit shorter, a little bit more exciting, and kind of show off a little bit more of the gems of California? You know, California is a massive state, and I know we got to get from point A to point B. But for me, man, making things a little bit shorter and a little bit more exciting would have been better. And stage 2, 3, 4, and 5, they're going to be putting in some hours on the bike. There's no doubt about it. And this time of year, maybe it's good for them, you know, as far as resetting the dials and starting preparing for the summer. But gosh, these guys race so long and so hard all year long that rarely do you see them do back to back to back to back 120, 130 mile stages.
Yeah, exactly. Like this is a pretty serious race now, and the teams send really good guys, but like there's over 20,000 meters of climbing and yeah, there's, you know, a couple of, several longer than 200K stages, which is savage. Like, yeah, 220, 214, 210. And they're not flat either. Each of those stages have some climbing. So it's a hard race. I remember when I did this race a few years back, we had a similar stage to tomorrow. And I remember guys after that stage, like, you know, you walked into the dining room and all the riders were just mad. Everyone was just like, you know, you'd just be standing at the lift waiting to go, you know, get the lift to go back to your room or whatever. And someone would just be standing there, another rider, and they just turn to you and they go, this is bullshit. and you're like, yeah, they can't treat us like this. This is insane. This race is so hard, you know. And everyone was like getting real grumpy.
And to quote one of my favorite lines from Pulp Fiction, you know, they've got the same stuff over there as we have over here. It's just a little bit different. And it's true. Like, they don't have their buses, they don't have their showers. You know, the long transfers, you know, in California, let's face it, there's a lot of traffic. When you get to the hotel room, you don't have all the frills and thrills because you can't bring everything over with you on the plane. Things are just a little bit different for these guys. So, you know, they're going to have to adjust to that. And, you know, they probably don't all have their personal chefs and their chef trucks like they do in Europe. I would bet a lot of money that they don't have that. So they're eating the buffet food, and sometimes the buffet food is good and sometimes it's not. You know, they're drinking different things. They just don't have their normal kind of support recovery protocols down the way they would have them over in Europe. So these long stages and then those transfers afterwards, yeah, it definitely is fatiguing, no doubt about it.
But that could be kind of cool too. Like, from a spectator's perspective, or at least from a race perspective, because like at least now it's like, oh, what can happen? Peter Sagan won this race against Julian Alaphilippe a few years ago. I know like 2 years ago a break went with all the climbers and GC guys, like, you know, 80 kilometers from the finish or 75 k's from the finish. So weird stuff happens that doesn't normally happen, which is kind of cool. And I hope that, you know, because this year's going to, it's going to be hard. It's going to be so hard. Hopefully it doesn't deaden that. And it just encourages bunch riding. Quickly, let's get, who do you think's going to win the overall real quick?
Oh boy. I have to go with the Education First team. They have just so many guys that could be in there. You know, Rigo, of course, we know who Rigo is. TJ, we know his ability, his qualities as an athlete. When he's on, he's on. You know, but then you're looking at a guy like Lawson, and then Sergio Higuita. Like, this is a guy that just joined the team. He's like another one of these super kids from Colombia that have just progressed so quickly that they've fast-tracked him. And man, when you have the support of those four guys backed up by Taylor, your brother, and Alex Howes, man, that's a dangerous team. You can play a lot of different cards there.
If they're on, if all of those guys are on, they're really on, and each of them is capable. A lot of those guys are capable of winning the race themselves on their day, if not winning a stage, you know. So exactly, I think that's a good team, and hopefully they are all five.
But yeah, to answer your question, I want to go with Rigo. I think Rigo was in a really good place before he got injured. He went back to Colombia. He's training. He's fresh. He's got a great team. He's got a lot of morale, obviously, with an American sponsor. And that's kind of what it boils down to as well, is when you're going up these climbs and you're suffering for this sort of miles, you got to be doing it for a reason. And I know there's World Tour points and this, that, the other thing, but there isn't the pressure, the media attention, you know, the going through your hometown and seeing your families, that sort of thing. So it's going to have to be that X factor. Who wants it the most? Who's prepared for this the most? Who's kind of marked this on their calendar the longest? And maybe Rigo didn't really have this, you know, X as in the middle of the off season as a major goal, but I think he needs to get back on track, and I think he has the team to do it.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's going to be the sleeper. Obviously George Bennett seems pretty keen, and I reckon he'll go close. Richie Port's a bit of an unknown for me, but I think I'm going to pick a bit of an outsider. I think Rowan Dennis. He always seems to do well in the US. He's done well at this race. I mean, maybe it's going to be a little too steep for him on Saturday, but he's an incredible athlete, and he constantly kind of can reinvent himself. So let's see if he can, you know, have that breakthrough here.
The guys did not come all the way over here just to, you know, sit in their hotel rooms and watch Netflix. You know, they're ready to race. So let's get it on.
Speaking of Netflix, what did you guys do? I've always wondered this. Before Netflix, like, because when you were like racing back when you started your career between stages, like without a mobile phone and without, you know, on demand access to like all this stuff, what did you guys do at night?
Yeah, it was definitely not the same as it is now. I read a lot of books. I wrote in my journal, my training diary. I looked at my training, you know, was a total nerd in that way. You know, guys, I remember Tony Rominger. He was like one of my heroes, and he came to Cofidis the same year I did. And he was all about the DVDs. And I remember we were at a race in Spain, and he walked in, and I think he took David Miller with him. And David Miller came back like, you wouldn't believe what Tony did. And I said, well, what? He goes, and remember back in the day when they had DVDs and they were kind of all over the place, and CDs, and they kind of had like the top 20 CDs and that top 20 DVDs. He basically said, yeah, I want one of each of those. And like to David, who was making like NeoPro salary, and this guy just basically saying one of each, please. That was, you know, he was pretty shocked by that. The DVD player, you know, the older computers that had the DVD tray. You know, now all these computers are so thin, they don't have that I'm sure I have one or two of those sort of computers laying around here somewhere that got me through some tough times. But no, I was pretty much a homebody. I didn't really look outside for more stimulation. I was more worried about being calm, recovering as much as I could for the next day. So I wasn't one of those guys that was sitting down in the lobby drinking coffee and just basically talking until midnight. I was a little bit more regimented than that.
Gotcha. Yeah, that. I mean, no one's sitting down in the lobby drinking coffee nowadays. That's for sure. Or at least in my experience, everyone was, on their phones, head planted. You barely even talk to your roommate. Let's go to tomorrow's stage. We've looked like we mentioned it earlier that it's a big boy. Give me a rundown, Rancho Cordova to South Lake Tahoe.
Yeah, even before we get started on the course, we have to talk about two big things. And that's A, for me, jet lag. When guys got over here, what they did to prepare for it, how they adjusted. Did they come over and get on program right away? Were they taking melatonin to help, sleep at night and reset all the serotonin levels? Were they outside with in the sunlight, in the natural sunlight, without their sunglasses on? These are all sort of tricks that you use to get over jet lag. And 9 hours is pretty substantial, And then the other thing is just the altitude. Tomorrow, I mean, we always were told, and this is maybe something that we could, debunk in the legends section one day, is we were always told that if you went to altitude, you had to race within the first 24 hours, or it would take you 3 weeks to acclimatize. And yeah, these guys are not going to be at altitude for very long, but we all know that, with partial pressure and pressure gradient, it definitely affects the way that you can absorb oxygen into the blood and thus into the tissue. So there's going to be some guys that are caught out with that, I think. And this is extreme altitude. Yeah, 2,600 meters, a couple of those. But the real thing for me, because we did this exact same stage, well, the riders did, and I drove behind them, so I saw the absolute death march that it turned into, is you're basically climbing for like 80 miles. And it's not the steepest climb, but it's just one of those just grinders, and there's very little time to just kind of relax. Last year was a little bit different. They had some summits and then some descents and then another summit and then a descent and then the final over the crater into Tahoe. So this is going to be just, hey, tough it out, eat correctly, because when you're at altitude, you're a little bit more dependent on carbohydrates, with your fueling, with hydration. That's going to be super important, especially if it's, super nice weather and actually hot. It's going to be very, very difficult outside of the kilometers and outside of the altitude meters that you're doing.
How do you, just to, before, you said something really interesting there, and that's a lot of these riders are dealing with the jet lag, and we're coming into a stage that it's really the only time we hit proper altitude in this race, and it's for, it's relatively briefly, I guess. But how do you prepare? How would you be bringing your riders here to do that? How are you getting your guys off the plane? What day are they getting here? What are they doing to get ready for this?
It all depends. Were these guys that were doing the classics and, took a week or two off, or a week, not even, and then got them over here? But I think I would want to get them over here at least 7 days before the start. Anybody else, I would even say longer, especially if you could get up and go to altitude. I know that Richie Porte was up in Park City. Peter Sagan normally goes up to the Tahoe Rim area. Pete Stetna, I'm sure a lot of the Americans did some altitude acclimation days, weeks, months, who knows? So, I mean, it's tough because you got to remember this is just one race out of the calendar, and there are so many races that maybe if you have a guy that was specifically targeting this, you could get him over here 3 weeks early, put him up at a, up on top of a mountain somewhere, or up in Tahoe, which is, I used to have a house up there for that reason, and just get them used to that sort of scenario. But you know, you do at altitude, you do lose muscle mass. So you got to keep up with that in the gym or doing some torque work out on the climbs. So it's fickle, man, with altitude, with jet lag, with this kind of time of the year, which I would call the transition period between seasons. There's so many variables, and you could think that you crossed the T's and dotted the I's on everything, and then it just goes tits up. Or a guy could fly in 3 days before because he had a wedding to go to, and all of a sudden he's just pinging right away. So many different variables go into this, and that's what does make this race a little bit special.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a lot. So, details of the stage: 214.5 kilometers, 14,400 feet of gain. So that's over 4,000 meters. You get up, over 2,600 meters, like around 9,000 feet. It's meant to be sunny, a little bit of breeze, and yeah, like you said, it's a death march. I rode similar stage to this, a couple of years ago, and I just remember like. Not being, I remember just thinking the profile looks like it's a 100 kilometer climb, but like it's got to be barely noticeable, right? Like, man, you're climbing the whole day. It's like it messes with your head big time. So yeah, it's a hard way to start the tour, and it's gonna change the dynamic of the race, even if tomorrow's not necessarily as like drastically selective. I think it will change the rest of the day, and we'll see that. Run some people down. We've just got to quickly interrupt there because the phone's ringing. We didn't explain this at the top of the show, but we've got a super fan, huge sports fan out there. He's anonymous, has chosen to remain anonymous. And he's going to be calling in each day with a couple of questions. You know, he's the Cat 2. He's speaking on behalf of the Cat 3s who have been listening to the Cat 5s. So, these are going to come out of nowhere, and luckily we've got the coach here. Bobby J is going to take the control on this one, and sort fact from fiction, get rid of the superstitions. You know, I don't know, all that stuff that the Cat Fires want to know. So, super fan, give it to us,
fellas. Really happy to be talking to you. Big, big fan. I've had metaphorical posters of you guys tacked up in my garage in front of my rollers for these long winter nights here. Anyway, I got a quick couple of questions for you. All right. Let's see. I heard recently that EF Education racer Taylor Finney has been coaching himself. It makes sense in a lot of ways, since I'm sure he's had a ton of programs over the years from different coaches at every level. And he probably has like a free Training Peaks account or something like that, but kind of sounds a little risky. If you're not, you know, highly motivated like I am. How's this approach kind of taken at the Pro Tour level? I mean, is this something that a lot of guys are doing, or is this pretty rare? Are guys coaching themselves, or are they kind of just picking up Joe Friel's book and telling the team coaches to, you know, fuck off? Or how does it work? And you know, how's he doing this season? How's his season been going? I know he's in California this week. What's it looking like this week for him? He's got no TT. He's got a bunch of hills, and he's got a couple of GC contenders. Is he just there to kind of, you know, get Riggo on his wheel? Is Rigoberto just going to sit behind that big body and kind of ride the flats? What do you guys think? Big fan. Listen, if you guys have any actual posters of yourselves, send them my way. Otherwise, I'm going to keep listening. I'll talk to you soon. Ciao, ciao.
Cheers, man. Thanks for that. I do have a couple of portraits I like. I might send them your way, get a bit of feedback. But Bobby, you should take this one, obviously. You're the expert here.
I will admit that I've coached Taylor before, and I coached him. I basically, I have known him since he was a bump in his mom's tummy. I coached him before his accident, and I coached him after his accident. And he's a very unique individual, and he's gone through a lot of changes in his life. You know, when he used to send in his training, it was like a laser printer. And sometimes as a coach, you're like, wait a second, like it doesn't have to be perfect. Like this is kind of like a prescription. The execution doesn't have to match the prescription like 100%. And then it was a little bit different. And, you know, working with him through his injury, through his metamorphosis as a human being, I definitely started to understand where he was coming from. And he once mentioned to me that he wanted his training to be like a piano symphony. And I am very type A, and I know what it takes. And I've coached some of the biggest riders in the world and, you know, had a lot of experience with myself. And there, I do believe that there is an equilibrium there, a balancing point, a middle ground, if you will. And I'm very interested to see how this works out for Taylor. For me, I was a little disappointed with his spring campaign. You know, when we were working together and even before, I mean, all of us know Taylor's ability for the classics, especially Paris-Roubaix. And all I wanted for him was to have a clear run at the classics, because after his injury, he had to fight hard and he was in some dark places. And, you know, you're trying to give a little bit of rope and then trying to pull it back at the same time. And I just wanted him, and I want him in the future, to have a clean run at the classics where he is 100% on. And unfortunately, I didn't see that happen this year. I don't think he had any injuries. I didn't see him race that much prior. And one thing you got to remember about Taylor Finney is he's Taylor fucking Finney. He's a gamer. He's a beast. So I don't think you could ever count him out, even if he dropped out of every single race leading up to Roubaix. I was still expecting him to be in the final of Roubaix until we saw him on the side of the road, kind of blended into the crowd. And unfortunately, the stress that goes on inside that car with the DS, evidently he kind of passed them and left him there on the side of the road. And it's not like back in my day where when I had a mechanical one time, I actually had to stop and grab a bike from a wheel off of a bike of somebody that was riding next to me. And with those disc brakes and all this fancy tire widths and pressures, he couldn't do that. So I hope that he uses this race to build for the summer. I hope that he is that very positive teammate that looks after his team leaders. And man, I would love to see him come screaming down in one of these finishes and pull off a stage win like he did a couple years ago. I think everyone has to plan their work and work their plan. And that having another brain or another couple brains giving you information, giving you feedback, giving you accountability more than anything. I think that's what every really good coach is, you know, you want to not my way or the highway. You want to find a middle ground. But as an athlete, for me, when I knew someone was looking in at my files and it got to that last interval of the day where if there was no one looking at my files or who knows, maybe they never were. But like it drove me to say, wow, these guys are taking time out of their day to help me get better. And that's all coaching is, right? Is just helping someone get better. That I'm gonna give it a shot. And then when I did finish that workout, man, you're going home with a little spring in your step. You plug in your SRM, your Garmin, your head unit of whatever type these days, and you're proud. And you know, even if your coach doesn't get back to you, or even if he doesn't even look at it, that gave me the motivation to get through that hard interval. And yeah, there were days where you were just like, listen, I can't do this. Something happened. You know, my kids got sick. I didn't sleep well last night. I felt sick. That's a totally different story. But when you're trying to push yourself, sometimes you do need that external motivation to do so. But other than that, I don't know many riders, especially these days where everything is so calculated, that go full solo. I mean, there are guys that train in different ways and don't look at the numbers and don't really care about, you know, weight and whatnot. But those are very few and far between. But those are artists, and artists are part of our sport. And that mentality as a coach, as a DS, as a teammate, you have to accept and get the best out of that person. And, you know, but this is a cutthroat sport. I'm not saying it's all about winning, but you do have to perform. And, you know, when the time comes for contracts, you need to have those results that show for it. And, you know, that's just the name of the game these days.
And that's what it seems like. It's obviously like the rise of technology and science and its involvement in the sport, or its place in the sport. Like, you've kind of spanned that spectrum, right? You've seen, like, before the days of power meters. Like, how did you analyze stuff back then? Were you just like, fuck it, I'll just go, like, do 6 hours a day, and then if it sticks, you know, throw it at the wall? Or was there some sort of, like, voodoo that you can apply? Or what was the science back then?
Man, I mean, we were working with heart rate monitors, and then I was one of the first guys to adopt into the direct force power meter with the SRM coming out. I think I had that in 99. I mean, it had been out earlier, but I think I got my first one in 99. And yeah, that changed everything because a watt is a watt. Like, your heart rate is so variable. And I remember Dr. Max Testa was one of my first coaches when I was on Motorola. And, you know, there was your heart rate zones. And some days I could hit that threshold heart rate zone, which I remember was like 170 to 175, like with two fingers in my nose. And other times I couldn't hit it if I was basically sprinting up the side of a mountain. And I didn't quite understand why. But nowadays, you know, a watt is very specific because there's only, you know, the way that you create watts is torque times RPM. And the way that you create a heart rate, either a high heart rate or a low heart rate, there's 1,000 variables in that. So it definitely got a lot more specific. And yeah, that is dating myself saying that I actually used a heart rate monitor only. But yeah, that's the way it was. It was a lot of just throwing a ball against the wall and see if it sticks.
What's been the biggest game changer? Piece of technology. I asked this question. Or Lockie, my brother, asked this question to Juan Antonio Fletcher, and he said it was not power meters, but training peaks, like the ability to record and analyze your training. What do you reckon?
I would agree 100%. And those two kind of go hand in hand, because what would Training Peaks be, or any of these evaluation software platforms, what would they be if you didn't have data to put in there? But the way, you know, looking at a single SRM file back in the day, before the performance management chart, it was just a single snippet. It was like this is what it was today. But like, how did that affect you 3 days from now? How did the training that you affected you, you know, that you did 10 days ago or 20 days ago affect you? So yeah, I think that really gave, I always believe, like, understand what you're doing and why you're doing it. And, you know, all those graphs, you know, let's face it, it's a two-dimensional mathematical graph. It's a figure. It's not who you are as a human being, but it can really give you some insight into the, you know, am I tired? Am I fresh? Am I feeling good? Am I not? Because, you know, numbers don't lie. And that was always the hardest thing, I think, before training with a heart rate monitor, is you never knew when to take an easy day, because fatigue became so common that even when you were a little bit less fatigued than you were the day before, you thought you were fresh. And this evaluation software is amazing. The other really good thing that I like is just the wheels. I'm a wheel guy, and the way the wheels have come out and developed over the years, and how fast they are and how stable they are, that's another thing. Because I mean, when you're out on the road, you know, those are your two contact points between, you know, the road and your skin. That's got to be important.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that too, like with rims getting wider and tires kind of getting bigger and the impact that that's having. And yeah, I'm intrigued by that. So I reckon, like, if I was just, you know, Joe Blow wanting to go out and train for my local crit, you kind of said the takeaway from that monitoring those monitoring programs and that data collection is a big part of it's being able to predict recovery.
Oh man, to me, 90% of the guys that I've worked with, you don't have to tell them to train harder. The hard part is getting them to train less or to at least recover in between those hard sessions. You know, this is a tough man sport. Everyone loves to do 4, 5, 6 hours, but not many guys like to take a day off or to go out and do an hour to 2 hours, but with a super low TSS. They think it's just a waste of time. But yeah, recovery is so important. And I think it's a very overlooked thing because with all the pressure, with all the social media, you know, you always feel like you have to go out and do something because you're seeing everybody else do it. But man, a day off is a day off. An easy day is an easy day. Don't blur those lines.
Okay, so when you're in the end of the show tomorrow, you know, how are you, your expert opinion, give us your expert opinion on tomorrow. Who's going to win? Who's going to do what? How's it going to play out?
Oh boy. Picking a winner is going to be tough. I think that all the GC guys and some X factors are going to be together at the finish. I'm going to predict, I mean, Tom Squeenge, I mean, he's won this stage before. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's been up in, you know, probably training at the Wattage Cottage again. I'm going to pick somebody. I'm going to pick Tom's because he knows the stage really well. But it could be another total outsider that just jumps away because I do think it's going to be a selective stage, but it's not going to be the stage that determines the race.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Shackman, Maximilian, because he was, I watched him race the other week and he was like very impressive. And I think this kind of suits him. He's pretty punchy, but he can climb well. And you saw him today, he was getting stuck in that second intermediate sprint. So, but I mean, who knows? Yeah, who knows? It's going to, such an odd stage. So yeah, it'll be interesting. And just before we go, one last little bit. We are reaching out to a couple of the riders, like a couple of the guys in the race, and just asking them to give us a text on the stage, like immediately as it finishes. So I text Lockie, my brother, obviously, and he's a man of few words. So here's what he had to say. He said, sleepy start, lung-burning panic attack on the circuits, nothing lost, nothing gained. And then our show producer reached out to Lockie's teammate, EF Education's Alex Howes, and he had an equally kind of cryptic message, fake wind, flat roads, many conversations, slow ramp up, fast circuits, internal panic attack, speed, 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 find Rigo, finish, pineapple juice, chocolate milk, pad thai. So there's quite a bit there. There's quite a bit to unpack. Alex, if you're listening, tell me about fake wind. Tell me about the many conversations and pineapple juice. Is that some insider information that we don't know about? Thank you so much for listening. Follow the journey at velonews.com. Bobby J, a pleasure.
Thank you very much, guys. See you tomorrow.
VeloNews Voices is a new multimedia platform featuring a collection of cycling luminaries, each with their own distinct point of view and channel. Coaches, athletes, movers and shakers, visionaries, the old guard, the new guard, the vanguard. VeloNews Voices is how and where the story of our sport is being told now and into the future. Fizzo is hosted by Bobby J and Gus Morton, produced by Manual for Speed, edited by Eddie Rogers, and a special thanks to our anonymous superfan. Don't forget to share, follow, and subscribe on SoundCloud. I'm gonna go get some more.